Greetings.
Hello.
Hi.
We have a special guest in the building. We have Dr. Chikani to help us unpack quite a very serious issue for me. In an era where digital connectivity defines your access to opportunities and education and some essential services, we as a country are stuck in a position where the speed of your internet is largely determined by your postal code. I don't understand why that's still the point, but nonetheless, here we are. Dr. Chikani will be helping us unpack this and make us understand why so many years after democracy, telcos are still the gatekeepers of internet. Dr. Chikani.
Yeah.
Welcome.
I'm excited.
Yeah?
I'm not sure if I can answer that particular question. I can read the papers that do answer that in interesting ways about
the difference between telcos in innovating and banking sector innovating in this sector. But that's we might get there.
maybe tell us, how would you interpret the digital divide? Like, how does that frame out for you?
Yeah, well, the easiest one is that we're not unique in this problem. Okay. We're unique in the speed of it. Right.
What do you mean speed?
So if you go to the United States,
right,
the digital divide still also exists. Right. Oh. So there are rural parts of the United States where they do not have broadband infrastructure.
I bet you they're still on 2G, actually.
In the U.S.
In the middle of in the scale.
Oh, but maybe they're using GPS for 2G. They don't necessarily running cell phones.
But you can either view it as like a speed thing, but the logic of a general disparity between urban areas and rural areas.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? That in rural areas, in urban areas, it is easier to have high levels of connectivity, high bandwidth levels, because these are larger usage and the economies of scale make sense. Mm. Whereas in rural areas, it's just the economics of it don't make sense, which then necessitates the state to essentially say, how do we then get involved to rectify this problem?
Well, that would be my point. So I view it as almost as a simple economic one. Mm. So, you know, where there's a larger use case to implement that kind of infrastructure, it makes sense financially for a telco or even the state, for that matter, to attend to the to roll out higher fiber and broadband. But, you know, would you still define it as a representation of structural inequality?
Well, let's take it two steps back. So when the internet came into force, no one considered the internet as something akin to like a public good, right? Something that the state should actively be thinking about, right? So we're talking about like late 1980s, 1990s. I mean, the internet came to South Africa like in the middle of the 90s, essentially, right? So when you get the private sector getting that first mover advantage, essentially claiming this good as a private good, as time goes on, people's lives essentially dictate that if you don't have the internet, you are being left behind in a monumental way. So the question then becomes, is the internet a public good? Well, ideally, the internet should be neutral and it should be a public good. But the distribution of the internet isn't necessarily a public good because that requires infrastructure, that requires investment. And the question then becomes, should the state do it?
It's the same thing of, should the state build highways or should the private sector build highways and the problems that come out of that?
So if you think of it like the internet, like a highway, a highway has to be a public good, right? Because the private sector won't build fair and equitable highways because it's not cost effective. The internet originally wasn't seen as a public good, right?
Yeah.
So the network towers that you have to set up, the fiber optic cables that you have to lay out.
Right.
If you remember a company in Johannesburg called Neotel, Neotel and Vumatel did a lot of the extensive initial investment to get broadband infrastructure into Johannesburg, right? With the state assisting. It wasn't like it was the state's plan to do this. But when the internet then becomes, or being connected, let me not say the internet, but being digitally connected becomes this public good, right? It then begs the question, should the state take over, right? Does the state have the economic logic to kind of take over that type of infrastructure project?
Okay.
And the world over, the answer has generally been, no. The state doesn't necessarily want to touch this. So the state then regulates it, essentially. And they try and monitor it and they try and incentivize the private sector to provide infrastructure in the most rural of places. But that question is still driven by, can I make money from it?
That's a problem, man.
It's not enough, isn't it?
If you leave this to private, then private look at how much money can I make? So there we go. So We're stuck with the commission and the tribunal, and between those two, you never know what the hell is going on.
So here's a question. It was a while ago now. It must have been about 2012 or so.
Yeah.
You asked the question, is the internet a human right? And it was a kind of a little trend at that point. Mm-hmm. And at first you're like, yeah. Then you're like, no. Then you start getting into the details of it. And it's like, if internet is a human right, do we mean broadband access to the internet? Do we mean like 2G? How do we mean, like, infrastructurally, it becomes a more complicated question.
Yeah.
So like, yes, a human right in the sense of access to information and those kind of concepts.
Right.
But not so much in terms when it comes to infrastructure. And this, and I can't even remember the conclusion of that paper, but it's the same kind of the similar issue that's still ongoing today.
So you go,
but wait, if housing is a basic,
I was going to touch on that.
Mm. Right. If housing is a basic human need, what kind of housing suffices as a basic need? You don't need a double story or triple story as that.
So
you can have, there's a minimum, you can work a minimum around it, even with internet. If I'm a student and I need access, what access do I need?
So I swear I'm going to bring this back to digital governance, but I'm going to take a quick detour.
Go for it.
Right. So
we got a pro. Housing, got a doctor in the building, guys.
Housing is not a human right, right? Indeed. In of itself.
Okay.
Right. So our constitution is fantastic in many different ways, but the language is very important.
Ah.
So you have the right to access housing.
Okay.
And you have the right to access water. We're one of the few constitutions in the entire world that provides the right to access water. The rest of the world's just like, yes, we will do this, obviously, type of thing. And it's this access question that becomes important.
Right.
Right. So water itself, I mean, like housing itself is not something that like you just wake up and it's like a fundamental human right, because the state wouldn't be able to provide that for every single person. Yes. Right. So you protect the right to access. So the question then becomes, well, the internet, you can't really make that a human right. Right.
Okay. Okay.
But the question then becomes, does access to the internet become a human right, dependent on the society that you live in, if that makes sense,
right?
And that becomes the real question of our time that drives this digital divide debate.
Right.
But the question then becomes, when is it, and so I pose this question to my students all the time, when is it acceptable to leave people behind? So there's always this assumption that you should leave no one behind.
Right.
Right? We should just, everyone, there should be equality across the board. We shouldn't leave anyone behind. When you look at the reality of life and the way governments work, we often leave people behind in order to keep advancing. And the internet is no different at this point. It becomes, what is the scale of leaving people behind? And then what is the plan to allow people to catch up?
Mm.
And one of the problems we have in our country is that there isn't a clear-cut plan about how people will catch up in the long term. We've got tons of legislation, millions of pieces of legislation around this issue, but there isn't a plan outside of digital skills. What does that even mean?
Yeah, if you're talking access, then back to the topic of the conversation, the postal code is still what determines your access. So does the majority of the South African population have proper access to internet?
No. So no, we've got access to cell phones, which is a bizarre fact of life in South Africa, but not necessarily the internet. So I was mentioning before we kind of started this age-old argument of equality of outcome versus equality of process. This argument comes from the early 20th century when governments were figuring out what a bureaucracy was. And the basic principle of the argument is, should everyone have the same process when they access government or interact with government, or should everyone have the exact same outcome, right? Mm. So I'm going to give you one example. I'm going to link it back to digital. So the one example is, if we all go to a DLTC, right, to get our driver's license, right, the idea is that we all stand in that line and we all wait and then we get our driver's license. What if it was more efficient to essentially, some people can pay an extra amount and get their driver's license early, if that makes sense, right? So the equality, the process is unequal. Some of us have to stand in lines for hours and some people skip the line, right? We now see that in South Africa, if you go to the airport, there's a discovery line and then there's everyone else, right? In government, IDs. Some people can get their IDs through the banking sector. Other people have to go through home affairs.
Right.
So the debate of sometimes it is acceptable to not have the equality of process as long as the outcome is still the same. Right? So when it comes to digital access, the debate that the state is facing right now, not debate, they've kind of resolved it to an extent, is we are not going to rely on the equality of process.
Mm.
We're going to ensure that there's an equality of outcome, that if some people are digitally connected, the outcome of whatever government services, whatever good comes out of the internet, must be the same as someone who doesn't have that access. So you can't be disadvantaged in any particular way. So you might not be able to scroll Facebook, but it doesn't mean you can't get access to job information, if that makes sense. And the government has been trying to toe this line. The problem with that is that it just stops innovation, right? It forces you to essentially move very, very slowly as people are coming on. And as I said before, if you don't have a plan to then transition people so that everyone eventually gets onto the same process, then everyone then becomes stuck.
Explain a bit deeper why that stifles innovation. I mean, if it's equality of outcome is the intention, surely it doesn't stifle innovation in the sense that you can leap forward and then have the others
come. Yeah. So equality of process essentially incentivizes a unilateral approach to solving a problem that everyone has access to.
Mm-hmm.
Equality of outcome in particular essentially says, no, let's innovate. Let's help people get ahead faster, right? Yeah. So a really good example is equality of process would be all of us should go to SARS and stand in a line. Mm-hmm. As we file our taxes.
Which would stifle innovation.
If we said everyone had to stand in line. Yeah. We all have to have the exact same process. Vis-a-vis, hey, SARS, why don't you test out this e-filing thing with a couple thousand people?
Right.
This was 10, 15 years ago. That's now advanced to, as of 2 years ago, SARS essentially saying, and e-filing is a fascinating example of this, but e-filing comes out and SARS says, okay, we know that some people don't have access to the internet, but they've got mobile phones. But we also know they might not have all the information they require. So what we will do is that we'll create a program and a script that essentially says we will calculate your taxes without your consent and ask you after the fact. And we're going to trial this out with 500,000 people, 3 years ago? Trialed it up to 1 million people last year, if I'm not mistaken, right? If SARS said we will only trial this out once we know that every single person can be fall part of this process, there's no incentive for SARS to create that system in the first place. Equality of outcome ensures that there's an incentive structure, and it's very bad in government in general, but it ensures that there's some sort of incentive structure to innovate digital, right, rather than to equate or create equality around the digital world in SA. Best way to give that answer, I guess.
So here's
you're not satisfied yet.
No.
Because you're leaving people behind.
Yes.
So I'm also hung up on leaving people behind because I understand the economics of it. There's almost a clear economics to it.
Yeah.
But here's the next question.
Well, assuming that economists run the world, that's the problem.
Yeah. So technically, you could argue that everyone does have access to the internet.
Yeah.
Technically speaking.
Technically, you could.
However, the issue for me comes into...
WhatsApp is not internet.
Comes into... Of course it is. But the issue for me comes into cost of access.
Yeah.
So like data costs and so forth. And my question would be like, okay, say we're assuming the hurdle we've just been discussing, like technical access to the internet is largely there. If we follow the money... How does this pan out then in terms of data, in terms of actually accessing the internet in a functional way whereby you could be, running a business or something similar like that?
Yeah, so there's two ways to kind of understand that. There's the SA metric that kind of dominates how we understand data, and it comes down to spectrum, right? That there's not enough spectrum. We can get super technical about that conversation, but it's a boring conversation to have.
Stanley wants to have it, though.
It's a boring conversation to have because it's really about this relationship between the private sector and how much money they want to make.
Right.
And how much the private sector wants to invest in what we would call digital public infrastructure and this negotiation with the state. Right. The state essentially says we will give up spectrum if you do XYZ. Private sector says if we do XYZ, we're not going to make that much money. And also, we don't want new players. We don't want extra competition, which gets me to my more exciting way of understanding this, which is telecom sectors, which generally dominate internet infrastructure deployment.
Gatekeepers, they are.
Are inherently the worst type of market structure you could have. They're all oligopolies. Mm. Right, so there's 2 to 3 of them across the world. So right. Again, South Africa is not unique. We've got what? MTN, Vodacom. Cell C is struggling.
Telkom doesn't count.
I don't know if we count Rain, but Rain has been doing a lot of work in this space. And Telkom, right?
Yeah.
An oligopoly, by its nature, does not like new players coming in.
Right.
They like to be able to dictate the cost of goods, essentially, because they're competing amongst themselves, they can collude. It's very, very classic. So the more interesting debate is, why is it that we haven't gotten any new, outside of Rain, and that's a very specific intervention, any new mobile operators or telecom operators? And when it comes to digital public infrastructure, the same story plays out about the people who Neotel eventually turned to Liquid Telecom or something like that.
Right.
Vuma turned to Vumatel.
Right.
You get Centech, if I'm not mistaken. And then there's one other company that has a complete monopoly on getting from fiber to the undersea cables. Is that one monopoly? I forget the name of it.
There's one company that was a merger between Meziv and Vodacom that was stopped. And I think that's the company.
Oh, it could be that.
Yeah.
But essentially, you do not have competition for this, right? Compared to other places in the world, where in Europe, they said there will be competition.
Yeah.
Right? So we're not going to allow you to have an oligopoly over the entire European infrastructure. The United States kind of fell into this trap. So the real question then becomes, how do you incentivize new actors to come in? And as technology evolves. So again, simple solution of in the next 5 years, the introduction of eSIMs.
Yeah.
Will change the kind of marketplace for data consumption in our country, right? The big telecom companies knew this and said, we don't want to have eSIMs in this country.
Yeah.
And the first company that did it was Telkom. They tested it out. They realized that this is a bit of a game changer. And once they were allowed to do it and people could see the profits, then Rain was able to essentially jump on board to a certain extent. And Vodacom is kind of sneaking in there. But it wasn't because they wanted to do it. It is because Samsung and Apple came with phones that said, we're moving to eSIMs as companies, so you guys need to adjust. If they never did that, we would never have the prospect of eSIMs that will open up the market to cheaper data, essentially.
But you're kind of talking about almost like one basket of corporates and another basket of corporates. Like, where's government in this? Like, where would you say... who should ultimately control digital infrastructure in a country?
I don't think so. Digital public infrastructure, depending on like what components you're looking at, right? Mm-hmm. So I do work around what we call DPI, digital public infrastructure, and it's made up of a collective of things that are both digital artifacts as well as like physical things, like cables in the ground. Digital skills counts as digital public infrastructure, essentially, all the way to applications that you would have in government departments. Government's role is really dependent on how they view themselves towards citizens. So let me give you an example. There's two dominating thoughts about how government deals with digital transformation,
okay,
where the government views itself as a platform for government, or where the government views itself as a government as a platform, right? So the example I like giving is a platform for government is like government like a vending machine, right? We are the vending machine. We put our digital services online. What you see is what you get. And we regulate what is inside the vending machine, if that makes sense. We're the vending machine owner. We decide if there's lays, there's this, right? It gives you a semblance of control. It creates a level of equality, but it creates a problem of we don't really know what people want, right? So if I rocked up to a vending machine and I wanted a cappuccino,
right,
I can't get it. I'm stuck with Coke,
whatever buffet they've got in that machine.
Government as a platform is a different type of logic, right? Estonia's kind of gone this path. The UK is going this path. And the government as a platform, you view it, the best way to describe it is like an app store,
right?
Essentially, that you create the basic infrastructure of the App Store, but Apple and Google with the Google Play Store don't create every single app that's there, if that makes sense. You create the baseline infrastructure to allow citizens themselves to develop solutions. Now, the benefit of that is that government as a, and they both have pros and cons.
Right,
government as a platform has the ability to scale at a rate far larger than platform as a government, the vending machine.
Right.
Because it isn't reliant on government intervention. It isn't allowed, like government must dictate what happens. Government simply sets the rules. Now, if you're listening closely, this is very similar to
that
old.
That means leaving lots of people behind.
But it gives It gives lots of chance. But the question then becomes, does government come in and say, if we choose government as a platform to be the app store, we then need to ensure that every single person has access to that app store. So we go all the way back to the access question. The question then becomes, should that access be low data costs? Should it be that there should be a network tower in every single community? Should it be that they should be fiber optics in Bushbuck Ridge, Mpumalanga, for instance? And that's the question government needs to answer, depending on how much money they have to do this, obviously. And that's where I think government's role should be. Government is thinking about that. Their new digital transformation framework proposal that came out like last year is hinting at this idea of like a more open government, shifting towards shared services, all that jazz. It's all fancy language. But it all comes down to, can you convince the big private sector players to play ball? And that just needs regulation at that point.
What is that? What does that practically look like? Is that almost the government is subsidizing data costs in order to like bring it down? Is that a practical application of that?
So you wouldn't subsidize the data costs, but you would subsidize the cost of the physical infrastructure.
Right, essentially.
You would lessen the bureaucratic hurdles it takes to set up a network tower, if that makes sense. Vodacom will not go into the middle of the Northern Cape Kalahari Desert simply to cater for 1,000 people if it costs them multiple millions of rands to set up a network tower that is supposed to cater for hundreds of thousands of people, if that makes sense. Right. So government then needs to come in and say, how do we help? But again, this is old school.
Wait, what does that help look like? Are they
subsidies? Subsidies.
Right.
So the greatest one is subsidies, which is why.
Meaning government owns nothing.
Depending on where you are. So in urban, in rural areas,
there
would be like PPP deals, so private-public partnerships around the type of infrastructure that gets laid out.
Okay.
In more urban areas, you get less of that. It's more left to the private sector, and it all comes around your funding model for that in particular. But this is changing, right? So I gave eSIMs as an example of this, right? That you don't need physical SIM cards. You can use a SIM card. As long as you've got access to a network, you're perfectly fine. The other one is, and I can't believe I'm about to mention it, but Starlink, right?
Ah.
Starlink becomes a game changer because you change the entire logic of digital public infrastructure at that point because you don't have to physically put the infrastructure in place, right? It goes back to the old school notion of what the internet was supposed to do of like, you just need to be able to connect. Right? There should be no, that original precipice idea of it.
When people were still good.
People were still lovely at that point.
They didn't have Ellen look nice. And
they didn't have Twitter back then. The world is different now. But Starlink, and Starlink is not the only player in this game.
Is it?
Right. But
there's somebody who offers satellite internet?
Tons. The Chinese are doing it. So we are, they are, China is ramping up. It's one of those, I forget what the number is. Don't ask me to quote the number.
Yeah.
But China is sending satellites into space at a scale that no one, that we can't fathom at this point to create this online satellite network, essentially. There's a huge race for it. There's a really cool YouTube account that explains this in better detail. But anyway, that changes the logic of government then doesn't need to subsidize the telecoms companies.
Right.
Right. But it means you've got another problem of now you're dependent on this one organization.
Mm.
So you solve one problem.
Oh,
but you
could be the reason why Starlink never succeeded in South Africa. The telcos are blocking that.
That's a whole other story.
But also, but we won't get into this discussion now, but there's also, if you're relying on one particular organization to sort of level the access fields, You're talking about now data collection and all these, yeah, it's a whole these other bigger problems, yeah.
So but you have a huge...
Isn't that simplified, though? If you're dealing with one organization, then you create a relationship with them. Maybe you keep the data, you regulate
them much
easier.
So there's this company called Google, and they're so fantastic about, you know, not...
They're not evil at all.
...utilizing your data in nefarious means for profit.
Ergo, the Competition Commission, the tribunal. Competition Commission has findings. Tribunal, what are they doing about this becomes, the anti-competitive nature of Google?
So this becomes, can I go onto a more continental level,
okay,
rather than just SA? Right? Cool. Because the logic of the postal codes is equally applicable at a continental level. But at a continental level, we've got a bigger problem about the influence of big tech in particular,
okay,
and the disproportionate amount of influence that they have and the inability for African governments to regulate them at scale, right? So if, let's say, Starlink came here, or let's say it was Google, right now we've got like Microsoft's in them. Our ability to bully a Google into submission is relatively low to non-existent.
One organization.
No, dude. Look at the American government trying to regulate Facebook's and Google. It's almost impossible.
So this is, again, a deviation.
Yeah.
But I can talk about, it's a hard deviation. Legal Resources Center, last year, just before elections, ran a campaign to essentially say, misinformation on the internet driven by TikTok and X in particular, and Facebook. So they created adverts, xenophobic adverts,
right,
horrible adverts, put them up and said, I wonder if Facebook, Twitter, TikTok have the ability to take these down. Right, because they've really withdrawn their resources, or like minimized the resources. They didn't. Didn't have the capabilities to do it at all. Well, not capabilities, they just didn't have the resources to even focus on this in any particular way. So they go, they have a chat with them to say, hey, are you guys aware of this? And they said, yeah. Are you going to do anything about it? And you push on with life. So when we had Poppy, again, the Poppy Act, the Protection of Private Information Act, was supposed to create greater parity when it comes to digital protection or data privacy in the country, right? Before then, there was a huge amount of inequality around how people's data was protected. It has a mechanism there that allows you to regulate internet providers, over the top networks or providers as well, so like your WhatsApps, et cetera. It's there in the legislation. But you can write it down as much as you want, but if you don't have the power to regulate them, it means absolutely nothing. So our telecoms, if I bring it back to SA, we have the ability to regulate our telecoms, but our telecoms are also getting big enough that they can ignore us as well. Right. So the scale of MTN, even though South Africa is one of its biggest bases, the scale of MTN is soon going to get to a level where MTN can look at the SA government and say, nah, I think we're good.
Ooh.
Like, we're fine at this point.
Yeah, the issue of the tech state is another whole topic point, really. It's a funny conundrum, actually.
Why do we not have the power to regulate? Where does that power sit?
I mean, it's political will. It's expertise. So our Competition Commission is really good, right? So I really want to emphasize this.
Hey, look, they're going to get $300 to $500 million out of Google for our media... Struggling media houses, you know?
They're one of our better government institutions.
They're really good, right?
Okay. You can find people, but you're also stuck with, you can't find someone into oblivion and they leave the country or you make them bankrupt, because then you harm the country itself, essentially. And that's the purpose of a regulator. In the United States, they have the equivalent, they call it for at least the tech sector and data, the FCC. In particular, really plays a huge role in this. And it's all about balancing up how much you're willing to fine someone and punish someone and how much you're willing to make them change their behavior before you bully them so much that they say, we're picking up our toys and going home. There's some companies that don't have a choice. So Cell C learned this lesson very, very well, right? So Cell C a couple of years ago just learned this lesson, the government wouldn't come to their aid in any particular way, right? And it's just because it's business. The opposite end, you could just say, you know what we're going to do? Do what China did to an extent and be like, we'll just create our own state-owned network provider. Again, you need the expertise, you need the skills, and you need the hard money to be able to do that.
Where is private getting the skills from that government can get?
Oh,
corporate jobs. It's
corporate
like
jobs. It, this is a normal.
Gives you, there's an incentive for me to be an expert.
The government
in this
does
area.
Have the skills. The people are in private. Get them.
You have to pay them, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Oh, there's. What the finance minister say about
yeah, with the new. How that increase will pay for all the. We can't even pay salaries right now. I mean, we just got to the negotiation of like salaries last year. But again, we could digress.
Right.
But there is. So one of my colleagues from last year.
You've got a good heart, Stan.
You've got a good heart. So government, and I do want to say there's a lot
of like...
That
explains why I'm broke.
There's a lot of like good work in government and goodwill in government. There's a lot of government departments. So a really good one is like CAPSI, the Center for... Oh, what are they called? They're based inside DPSA, and their job is to like look for innovation in government and reward that innovation in government.
Oh.
CPSI, sorry. That's I forget what it stands for, but it's right. CPSI. Great guys. Lovely work.
Look for innovation in government and reward
yeah,
it.
So if there's a local government department that says, you know, we've digitized something or we've created public records and made it open, you look for that. You say, how did you do it? And then you share that knowledge with other government departments at a local level, right? We can talk about why government can't innovate as well, but that's a, that's a separate type of conversation. But when my colleague Halfdan was kind of looking at government and our team went to Denmark, kind of knowledge share, kind of figure out like what's going on. If you want government, because at the end of the day, you want skills, right?
Yeah.
You want skills. It means that there's two ways you can go around like digital innovation in the state. The one is every single government department has a team of software developers. Simple, right? A highly skilled, highly paid team of software developers with a proper project management team or PMO around them. And a some sort of mandate that is given from some higher structure, whether it's the minister or some other structure in of itself. And most government departments kind of started that way. Or government departments, listen to myself.
Mm-hmm.
Most government digital transformation initiatives in governments across the world started that way.
Yeah.
Right. So it's decentralized.
Right.
Then you realize there's just not enough skills to do this, right? You're really pulling, you're essentially, you start scraping from the bottom of the barrel. You're not getting the top of the top skills, and therefore the interventions that you create aren't particularly good, right? You're harming citizens' experiences or perceptions of the state. So you get a reconsolidation of this over the 2010s of, okay, every government department can't have their own team of software developers doing their own particular intervention, because then government becomes a bit of a mess at that point. And they say, well, we have to have one central agency that runs these initiatives. And depending on the type of government, you can either put that agency as its own government department.
Mm-hmm.
You can put that agency inside the equivalent of the president's office. Or you put that agency inside of National Treasury.
Okay.
Which is fascinating.
That's interesting.
Right? If you put it as its own government department, doomed to fail. Because other government departments will look at you and be like, but we're on the same level. Why would I have to? Why do I have to listen to you in any particular way? And it also needs strong coordination in the state. When it's in the president's office, yeah, it kind of works depending on the country that you have. But the solution that works the most is National Treasury, because it's where the money is, right? Any project that you do needs to have money at the end of the day and needs to be resourced adequately. And National Treasury will not, or the equivalents of National Treasury do not like wasteful expenditure. So we'll only find the best skills possible and the best projects possible in particular, right? But if you do that, it means you minimize the amount of innovation that happens in the state. You get really good innovation that happens, hopefully at scale that everyone can experience it, but it's a lot smaller in the amount of interventions you have. So back to, do you leave people behind?
Yeah, well, you know, treasury just create hackathons. Done.
Look, I mean, this is kind of a this is a bit of a side.
It's not a complicated issue. You have the power. Just create hackathons, man. Then people come.
It's just like government easy. Works, though.
Yeah, they would have to
just create this thing and then hope someone carries it.
It's a bit of a sidebar, but I mean, it would be an ideal world whereby, you know, the government attracted the you almost provided the framework to the same person that would be attracted to a corporate framework. And in the sense, there's trajectory there, there's ownership, there's high salary growth, there's all these issues. Government doesn't have that for the most part.
Well, they don't have that.
Unless you dive in, unless you go. You know.
So I was actually joking around with a government official about this, where I was like, you guys get paid so much for the work that you do that I'm pretty sure private sector's looking at you being like, yeah, we'll jump ship.
Right.
So at a very, very top level, there's like a level of parity when it comes to salaries, right? For the rest of government, not so much. But the bigger issue you have, let's go back to like innovation and the right skills. So you could have the best skills. You could have the right people in there. And as any government official will tell you, the biggest headache they have, generally speaking, is something called PFMA, which is very depressing. Because PFMA is probably one of the reasons why like state capture and corruption did not go at the level that it could have gone. So PFMA stands for the Public Finance Management Act. The structure of that act is inherently against innovation in the state.
What?
It makes it really difficult to experiment with new interventions. It makes it really difficult because it's all about how you manage procurement at the end of the day. It makes it really hard to innovate. So if there's a problem, I can't just say, I'm going to hire a team to solve this problem, if that makes sense. It is, I want to solve this problem. Okay, I now need to go do an RFI. But now I must go find someone to do the RFI. But then I must do essentially a procurement process for someone to do an RFI. Mm. Right? You then do the RFI. The people tell you this is what the problem is. You knew what the problem was, but you need to hire someone to tell you what the problem was or is. Then you figure out what the problem is, and then you ask for an RFQ.
Why do you have that process?
Right? It's to ensure that you don't misappropriate funds, right? Mm. And it saved us. Yeah. PFMA is a brilliant piece of legislation.
It
just stifles innovation. But it was designed at a time in which the scale of innovation that could happen in the state wasn't at the pace that we have now. Yeah. So the question then becomes, how do you update it? Because
to update law is not easy. It takes,
Well, think of it this way. If you knew that this is the one piece of legislation that stopped the worst forms of corruption that could have happened.
There we go.
And someone comes to you and says, I want to change it.
Yes, let's do it.
Most people would say, ooh, let's just wait. What exactly do you want to change in this thing?
I understand that, So
we're not changing it because we'll expose corruption?
No, because it's stopping corruption from taking root in a lot of government departments. So if someone
comes you're not stopping it because there won't be corruption?
Sorry, say that again?
If we stop it, there will be less corruption.
No.
The fact that it is in place has stopped the amount of corruption that could have happened. So if someone comes in and says, I want to change this, the first question would be, for what end? That becomes the first question.
Right, we need to accelerate innovation.
And they say, by how?
Yeah, but...
We need to lessen the ability...
If you remove checks and balances, essentially it opens the doorway for more corruption.
Yeah, obviously when you innovate, you cannot innovate for corruption. You innovate against corruption.
And that
is not innovation if it opens homes for corruption.
And that is the struggle of our time. Right. But again, this is not necessarily linked to like postal codes.
Different thing,
but it's a fascinating debate.
So just to bring it home a little bit, I mean, what would be your ideal then if we're looking at infrastructure, if we're looking at government involvement, if we're looking at private company involvement, what would be an ideal mix for you within the South African context? I mean, what does that look like for you?
Yeah, if I was a bit of a dictator and I could bully people, I would make sure that no one is left behind. Because
at least I'm onto something.
Because you can see the net benefit it gives you in the long term. Mm. But it requires, you can't just say, I want to give people access to the internet.
Okay.
Having access to the internet is neither here nor there.
Right.
I can have access to the internet and spend the entire day on TikTok. Yep. Like, there's no productive use that necessarily comes out of it.
Majority of the population will just watch porn or something.
Which Scott, is, are not
quite
all
frankly,
like
no, absolutely not.
No, I... Yeah, South Africa doesn't publish these stats, but I am pretty sure the majority, like in every country, would just be watching porn. It's just a fact of life. This is why the United States, certain states are like asking for age verification.
Are you guys sure you're South Africans?
Anyway. I just lost my train of thought.
You know, they wouldn't spend the day on TikTok or something.
Oh, yes, like they would spend the day. So I go back to Shenzhen. Shenzhen is a great example of this.
Right.
So Shenzhen is a city north of Hong Kong, so South China, essentially. When I say just north, it's across the river from Hong Kong. Shenzhen, in 2025, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, was a nothing city. It was just rivers and rice farming and pretty much it. Fast forward 30, 25 years later, it is one of the tech capitals of the world, right? And one of the biggest investments was not necessarily we're going to bring big tech companies here. It was we want to create digital skills amongst the populace. And digital skills wasn't just, I know how to start up a laptop.
Right.
It was, I know how to code. Right. So I understand this laptop and I understand how to code.
I can fix this
because then that creates secondary industries. So Shenzhen secondary industries was, we'll take the Samsung, we'll take apart the Samsung, and then we'll make our own Samsung at that point. Or we'll make the little parts that need you to replace, such as the screen, such as the screen protector, such as the microphones, etc. Become proficient at that. I go back to when we talk about digital public infrastructure. And this is why I get... When we talk about digital transformation, we just look at like internet connectivity. It's like such a small piece of the pie of the disparity that exists, that the entire picture should be the digital skills that comes with you, both the physical digital skills of like, do I understand how this machine works?
Right.
Do I understand? And then the soft digital skills. Do I know how to program? Right. You don't need to know how to code, but can you read code? Type of thing. We don't all know how to write a novel, right? But we all know how to read, generally speaking, right? So do you have a semblance of understanding what code means, right? You can do basic activities in this. Those skills often need you to have the internet. So having the internet is like, yes, but what is the plan to then bridge the divide for all the other aspects when it comes to digital public infrastructure in particular? And I think that becomes the question. So that's why I say I wouldn't leave anyone behind because it's not, I treat it like education. You can't come back and say, some of you are not going to get an education at all. if that makes sense. I mean, you kind of do it, but you don't announce it and be like, yeah, Mpumalanga in particular, we're not going to provide any basic education. And that's what I mean about that type of logic. But that takes the economics out of it completely. Right? It changes the logic about how the state deals with this phenomenon of connectivity. At its basic point.
This is slightly unrelated, but how did we get it right with mechanics? It's easier to find a mechanic around the corner than it is to find somebody who fixes phones. Largely from, let's say, the black South African.
That's beyond my pay scale. But mechanic doesn't require the infrastructure that we're talking about.
No, I'm saying the ability for one to learn how computers work. How to fix them.
So yeah, so that type of logic.
Right. So, but it's easier to find somebody who can overhaul your engine. In the same community, you wouldn't find somebody who would know how to fix your laptop. But the mechanics...
Yeah, no, I follow the logic. Yeah.
The mechanics of, of cars and things are not
taught in school. Give it time.
I mean, I don't know that marketplace.
Right,
that labor market well enough. But it is that same type of logic. If someone is... So I'm going to steal that example from you. If someone is able to take apart an engine, regardless of the engine, whether it's a Mercedes-Benz, a BMW, whatever, and understand like how this thing works, the same logic applies to digital skills.
Right.
We often make it seem like you need to have... So government is facing this problem. So government has realized, it was at like some conference a couple of years ago, every year, government releases its like priority skills list. Essentially, it's like, what skills do we need as like a state for like the state to function? And computer science is always like on that list.
Yeah.
The logic then was, most people are going to get their computer science degree via like a university because they were the only people kind of offering this.
Cool.
Then we found out like 3-4 years ago that a huge chunk of private sector employment for computer scientists and data scientists did not have a university degree. They just got it by being on the internet.
Yep.
And they learned it themselves.
Right.
Right. So it's created like this interesting, and I know, can I talk about this? I can't talk about this company, but there is a big-ish company in our country that essentially says, like, we'd rather hire someone who doesn't have the university degree.
Like, oh, yeah.
I've got to be honest, I don't give a damn about university.
Yeah, it's like, days. Why no are we doing this? To the prof. Listen, but this is why I do philosophy work. Philosophy is never going to die.
But
guys.
I mean, yeah.
We had an intern from your university. I mean, shouldn't mention.
I mean, you can say the University of Witwatersrand.
This is a master's degree computer science student. He could not put a line of code in the back end of a mobile app.
Yep.
This master's degree.
This is not an uncommon thing. This is the world over, right? So it's forced government to rethink its pipeline of skills. Because originally when they thought about the pipeline of skills, it was, we'll give the universities a ton of money. Now, if you don't give the universities a ton of money anymore, because the universities are not necessarily providing the skills that the private sector wants, who on earth do you give the money to? Conundrum of your time.
But what is access? Back to the mechanics example.
Yeah.
What access did we get to cars that gave us this knowledge to overhaul the engines without having been to university? And what access do we then need into the digital world to give us the same skills without necessarily having to go to a university learning the coding languages? What is access in those terms?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think back to, okay, clearly we didn't have a convention where we went, hey guys, let's learn mechanics.
So here's a really good one. So like South Africa's not particularly good at this.
Yeah.
But Kenya is. Kenya and Nigeria are. So if I'm using this mechanics example, it's because cars are plentiful, right? They're saturated. It's like you can't go somewhere without seeing a car, right? South Africa's got the equivalent of that. We've got cell phones, right? So computers aren't plentiful, but phones are plentiful. And there was some, this is an old stat that people used to talk about, that the amount of phones in South Africa is essentially meant that every single person had two phones in the country. We had more phones than people had access to electricity at some point. I'm pretty sure that's been resolved now, which is like, where did you charge your phone? People then did a study on it, and they found out they charged their phone at community places such as spaza shops. Essentially, it was a very simple solution. But we then don't think about how do we, A, commercialize these phones, right? How do we make money from these phones? So we don't just use these phones to put airtime in and whatnot. How do we create commodities is not the right word. I want to say business, but I guess I'll go with business. So the benchmark of all benchmarks, M-Pesa is a great example of this, right? Of utilizing your phone, right, in order to create financial inclusion. You create this juggernaut called M-Pesa in particular. Vodacom tries to do an M-Pesa-like system in South Africa, and the culture is just not there.
Was that a culture or just? I mean,
well, it's also Vodacom being bad at its implementation. But Vodacom, I still want a job one day, so don't. But it comes back to like, what do you do? Can I mention his name?
I don't mind.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm now blanking on his name. So it's the current head of Uber in SA.
Okay.
We did like a panel discussion with him a couple years ago, and he made this point that is like lives rent-free in my mind, where he says he like doesn't like communism and socialism. He's like, I don't understand people's fascination with like the means of production of capital and this and this. And he says one of the strongest means of production that we have right now is someone's cell phone. That with a cell phone alone, so long as you're connected to the internet, you could create an entire business without inventory, without stock, without anything, and turn a revenue simply from your phone. And the culture on the continent in particular is leveraging that, the opportunities that open up about how you use your connectivity to generate income at a local level. So it's not the big telecoms, at a very local level. And we just aren't there yet. And a lot of it is the skills, the desire, and the culture at that point. It's not to say South Africa won't get there in any particular way, but it's like a really nice stark comparison when you kind of compare the culture in Kenya and Nigeria vis-a-vis South African rural areas or township areas and the differences.
And how much of that is related to the monopolies that exist here versus in countries like Kenya. For example, let's go to the M-Pesa example. Mm. In my observation, M-Pesa failed here because
it's competition here.
Right.
It's hot.
Vodacom, there's MTN, MN. Mm. It succeeded in Kenya because Safaricom is ubiquitous there.
Yeah.
80% of the population, they are on that mobile operator. So everyone is using this. So it makes it easy. It's easier to work there.
Yeah.
How much of that problem is evident in South Africa?
Yeah, no, it was until it wasn't.
I see.
So, and again, I use international comparisons. So M-Pesa couldn't work in the United States until 6 years ago. Right, so there's also like certain regulatory things that stop innovation in when it comes. Let's talk about financial inclusion as a form of like inequality when it comes to digital transformation. Now, don't quote me on the exact nature of this regulation. It's when I used to work in the private sector, so you can't necessarily create an M-Pesa in this country purely because of government regulation of you can't hold more than like 4 million rand. If you're not a bank, essentially, if you're not like a financial institution, you can't rock up and essentially say, I want to manage a payment between the two of you.
Right.
Right. So if you guys have heard of like Cash App in the States, right? Mm. I want to facilitate a transfer of money between the two of you. You guys have two different banks, and I don't want you to open up your app. I am App Cash. Let me not do copyright infringement here. You give me your 100 rand for this dinner that you owe him. I will hold that, right? But I have to function like a bank because I'm getting all this money from everywhere. There has to be a level of money that I have in the bank at any given moment in time so I can pay out everyone, right? So I can do that instant transfer of money between the two of you, but the money is still like in my hands. I only give it to you. It's a simple bank. I only give it to you when you need the money. You can't do that as a financial startup in this country because the regulations are you have to be a bank to hold an X amount of money. I forget how much it is.
Hmm.
But that what's the word I want? Threshold and figure means that it is never worth creating that type of solution to financial inclusion, right? Unless you're a big behemoth like Safaricom. Hmm. Safaricom said, change this thing.
Right.
And national trade, their equivalent of their equivalent of the Reserve Bank changed that regulation in Kenya many, many years ago. South Africa, just absolutely not. Again, digital innovation comes from competition, more people in place. I sound like a capitalist, but it is true. Have you noticed how if you are a tech startup in this country that is trying to democratize digital inclusion or digital innovations or whatever it is, you want to give people options. Have you ever noticed how quickly they get bought up by a big telecom company or a big bank?
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because the big banks don't want those changes in any particular way. A great example, they will never say this publicly. SnapScan. SnapScan could have been the solution to a lot of financial inclusion problems in the country way before, what's the new POS company that everyone has like their POS system? Way before them, without the need
Yoko.
Yoko. Right? Where Yoko, you need like the physical infrastructure to do this. Well, with SnapScan and Zappa, in the past, you just didn't need that physical infrastructure. You just needed your phone. Right? You could start your business wherever you wanted. You could solve the issue of never having cash for a car guard. Right? Overnight. All of these problems would be solved where you create financial inclusion. They start swallowing up market.
Right.
So Standard Bank buys them. So SnapScan can be the solution to this. And they'll never say this. SnapScan gets bought up by Standard Bank. And Standard Bank sits on them. Because SnapScan is a threat to their market.
Right.
There's nothing complicated about it. So there's this incestuous, again, comes back to like oligopolies and the sphere of competition. There's this desire of like any big startup that gets created, buy it, sit on it. And in certain instances, take on their tech for your particular process. And if we can't figure it out just as yet, we will do it at a later stage. At some point, it's really good, right? So Take A Lot is a great example of this when they bought out Mr. Delivery, right, to use their underlying tech platform. Pick and Pay is a bad example of this, where Pick and Pay bought, there used to be an app. It used to be the number one app in South Africa. It was this alcohol delivery app. Essentially, won multiple awards. I even forget its name. Pick and Pay bought it because Pick and Pay thought, we're going to do our delivery system thing. Pick and Pay wasn't ready to go into the market yet, so they sat on that company until Checkers 6060 essentially rocked up and said, we'll do this. Mm. I forget, and Checkers 6060 bought another company in order to do this as well. Right? So there's examples of, I can buy a tech startup, take on their tech platform, implement it in my company. But when it comes to financial inclusion, we just don't see any of that. And there are dozens of financial inclusion startups that are created every single year. If you become successful, 100% be bought out. And if I started it, I wouldn't complain. I'll take my check and I'm go on to the next initiative at that point.
I think we're over time. We've been chatting for over an hour. I would I could easily sit around and chat for another hour.
I rant and rave about these
things. So we might have to park it there. But great chat. Appreciate it.
Yeah, this is super fun. Good. There is hope. You know, we don't have to leave every single person behind. There's an inevitability about it. There's a cost to change. There's a cost to transformation in societies.
Right.
The question then becomes, and this is why I will not lose my job, the philosophical question, if you quote a good old-fashioned John Rawls, is how do you ensure that societies structured in such a way that the worst off in society are treated the best?
Right.
Right, that regardless of if you're the worst position possible in society, that society structures are created in such a way to keep you afloat, right? To keep you alive. So even though we're advancing, you're still treated the best way by the state. And I think that type of logic could still keep the innovation without leaving too many people behind at that point.
So you are president tomorrow.
Mm.
How do you shorten the digital divide gap from maybe start with MNOs and all related private sector actors to regulation?
I wouldn't overly complicate it.
Okay. Digital, what do you do with MNOs?
You think about this not as like a 5-year plan, but you think about this as a 30-year plan. If I'm president at this point, I'm now thinking I've got multiple terms, right? I don't just have my one term to worry about. I'm like the ANC in 1994.
I'm here until Jesus comes, right?
I would not favor short-term interventions that incentivize essentially compensating short-term interests of the telecoms, the banking sector, and this. You need to have a long-term horizon of, and the basic skills are digital skills.
Okay.
Right? Digital skills, making sure that every school over the long term, so not in the next 5 years we're going to build a smart city.
Right.
Over the next 30 years we're going to make sure that there's an army of teachers who are capable of teaching digital skills in particular. Right, so that you can teach code without a computer.
Mm.
Right, you can teach code without a computer. It's the basic logic of things that you need to understand. That regardless of what school, that has to be on the curriculum at that point. That then incentivizes people to then say, well, we need to make sure that the schools are all connected at that point. So I would start there and give it a 30-year horizon. As long as you're trying to do short-term fixes, then you have to listen to the MTNs and the Vodacoms and what their interests are. And will they be willing to build the network connectivity? We'll just be a dictator. Sometimes being a dictator, you can get the job done.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's Dr. Chigani. If he's president tomorrow, we have a dictator to show him the digital divide.
A benevolent dictator.
Still believe in democracy, guys. It works.
Thank you so much for tuning in. This has been the Angle Podcast.